And it's time for It Says in the Papers from Deirdre Purcell.
There's an image of joy unconfined on the front page of the Irish Times this morning as an ecstatic Kerry supporter rushes to greet his equally thrilled team heroes seconds after the final whistle blew yesterday in Croke Park. The picture was taken by Donal Farmer. The Irish Examiner's front page showcases Morgan Tracy's picture of the Sam Maguire Cup being held triumphantly aloft by Kerry's Killian Young, while the Irish Independent's joy is vested in its front page celebratory snap of player Kieran Donaghy. The lead reports for all three papers are somewhat more sobering, however. The Independent security editor, Tom Brady, writes that politicians and civil servants found guilty of corruption will be forced out of office and banned from returning to their posts for up to 10 years, according to new legislation that will give extra powers to the courts and strengthen the ability of the Director of Public Prosecutions to bring criminal charges against suspects. Fiscal Council says tough budget necessary is the headline over Arthur Beasley's story for the Irish Times in that pre-budget report. He writes that the Council, an independent statutory body, says that, as you heard in the bulletin, by adopting a prudent budgetary stance, the government can send a strong signal, reinforcing its stated resolve to rectify the remaining weaknesses in the public finances. And Beasley adds that it has never before issued a pre-budget statement, so its intervention reflects its concern that fiscal discipline is being relaxed. The Examiner runs that Fiscal Council report on its front page too, but for its main story this morning, Catherine Shanahan writes that public hospital services for treating children with potentially lethal allergies are completely swamped, with year-long waits for first appointments and 3 years for a food allergy test, in this case meaning that children could be subject to further risks of anaphylaxis. The Irish Daily Mail leads with Paul Caffrey's story that 400 prisoners are to lodge claims for early release as a result of new rules which will increase the period of remission on sentence from one quarter to one third. While in the Irish Sun's main story, Mark May and Tom Morgan write that a camper van carrying seven men was stopped by police as it disembarked from an Irish ferry at Holyhead yesterday, having set off an explosives trace alert. As a result, there were swoops in London and southeast England, and while six of the men were released without charge, last night the seventh was still being quizzed by police who are liaising with Gardaí. And the Irish Daily Mirror's lead this morning by Elaine Kyo is illustrated by a photo of the injuries suffered by a man who was allegedly attacked as he stood outside the house where his grandmother was being waked in Dundalk. And this one for fans of international soccer, also in the Mirror. FIFA officials have apparently blocked the release of a huge report, 350 pages, with 200,000 pages of evidence attached into alleged corruption in Qatar's bid for the 2022 Soccer World Cup. Dry roast peanuts are more likely to trigger an allergic reaction than the raw kind. That's in the Examiner. And finally for now, Ireland has become the first EU country to open a consulate with outposts for Enterprise Ireland and the IDA in Austin, Texas, which is America's fastest growing city. Ireland's newly arrived Irish Consul General is scouring the capital for office space to set up Ireland House in this city, to which 110 people now move every day, and where the motto is "Keep Austin Weird." That's in the Times.
Emma McNamara joins us with the business news. And just before you get into it, an interesting and largely positive editorial about Ireland and the economic state of the country in the Financial Times this morning.
Positive, but with several warnings about where the economy should be heading. Its editorial says that the tough choices on the Irish economy have already been made, but it says that early glimmers of optimism about the recent deal on the promissory notes exiting ESM, the request to pay the IMF early, and 5-6% economic growth shouldn't be mistaken for a return to the carefree days of easy growth. Ireland is not out of the woods, it says, and public debt will remain at dangerous levels for many years, with private debt even worse. worse. It says that Ireland has to fix an unbalanced housing market with empty ghost estates coexisting with a housing shortage in Dublin. And one interesting paragraph, it has the hangover from years of heedless expansion has left Ireland with no choice but to seek growth in other ways than starting the party all over again. And it says that we're going to have to rely on exports and attracting overseas investment for future growth. And as we've been hearing, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council has warned in its pre-budget statement that it will become politically difficult as memories of the economic crisis fade to sustain the fiscal discipline needed to reduce the national debt. The council says that in the past, fiscal policy here has shown an unfortunate tendency to contribute to boom and bust economic cycles with negative social consequences. And it says that breaking the pattern now is crucial, and there's going to be more on that throughout the programme. And elsewhere, Oculus, the virtual reality firm that Facebook bought in March for $2 billion, is nearing the consumer release of its Rift virtual reality headset. It showed off its new prototype at Connect, a first developer conference held in Los Angeles at the weekend. It has an improved display, motion tracking and audio features that its chief executive said brings the Rift headset much closer to a finished product that can be sold at retailers, and that's due out sometime next year. On the currency markets, the euro is trading at $1.2863 and at 78.68 pence sterling.
Emma, thank you.
The Finance Minister Michael Noonan said last week he could achieve his budget target of cutting the government's deficit without having to raise taxes or cut spending. That's not what the Fiscal Advisory Council is advising him this morning. We're joined by our economics correspondent, Sean Whelan. Sean, growth is up 7% according to the latest figures. Government revenue is up as well. So why is the council advising, in effect, more austerity?
Well, not more austerity, but what they're saying is finish the plan. They said things have been turning around, according to the Fiscal Council, because the government have a plan and they stuck to it. Strangely enough, that's what the Taoiseach and the Finance Minister and other ministers were saying last week. We've got to where we are because we have a plan and we stuck to it. But the last bit of the plan says, for budget 2015, you need a consolidation of €2 billion. And the Fiscal Council are saying, stick to that plan and do that consolidation by way of additional taxes and reduction in expenditure rather than just relying on revenue buoyancy, which is what the government seem to be planning to
rely on. Exactly. That runs almost exactly counter to what Michael Noonan was saying when those figures on growth came out. He said we can do this without tax cuts and without cutting spending.
Indeed. And the reason the Fiscal Council are saying that is they're going back into this discussion about what is a structural deficit and what is a cyclical deficit. It all gets very technical, but basically the structural part of the deficit is that bit that is still there, even when your economy is rising. And if your economy falls, which it will at some stage, you're going to be stuck back with this structural element. So they're saying make changes to the structural deficit now. Deal with this issue now rather than trying to do it later on, because once the money starts to flow, it's going to be extremely politically difficult, if not impossible, to find that additional money to deal with that structural deficit. And if things do start to turn down again later on, you're going to be back in a painful future. So they reckon you have to deal with the issue now. And if there is spare money coming through in the system, that's great, that's fantastic. But bank that money, save it for the rainy day, because the rainy day is going to come, and make your adjustments and make them in a permanent way and get it done now. And if you can reduce your budget deficit faster, do it, because it's just really important to do that, because we have massive debt and massive deficit.
And they remind us, next year, even with things going well here at home, we'll be 7 billion, we'll be spending 7 billion more than we take in.
That's right, you borrow that money and you add it on top of the national debt, which is already 215,000 million euro.
Now, of course, they're not politicians. They're doing what they have to do, which is advise the government in an objective way. So in terms of spending, what if the government were to take a little bit of their advice even, what might this mean?
Well, they are making the point that I think they're shifting some of the emphasis of the debate of recent weeks back onto the spending side, because if things start going well, as they are going now, it's quite easy to not put up taxes. It's a lot harder to not increase spending. And a lot of the emphasis now is going to come on to the issue of spending control. Again, Michael Noonan was praising his assistant down in Merrion Street, or his co-worker in dealing with this financial crisis, Brendan Howlin, and saying he's been keeping spending control or control over spending, and that's been really important. But keeping spending control is going to be really important going forward as well. Fiscal Council are making the point that these new fiscal rules that we all voted into our constitution a couple of years ago constrain the amount of money that a government can spend in any one year, and the government have also applied their own spending cap on each department, and that again is acting as a weight on expenditure. Now, under the fiscal rules, they have to effectively reduce spending over the years ahead. There's another comprehensive review of expenditure being carried out by Brendan Howland's department right now. He's asked them for substantial cuts in their spending, and all the departments have come back and surprisingly have asked for substantial increases in their spending. So whilst we're all focused on the tax debate externally, internally the government is focused on the spending control issue, and that is going to be really tough going forward because, as the Fiscal Council point out, there are a lot of demographic pressures in the system here. Natural population growth means there are more children who will be seeking social welfare transfers through the children's allowance. At the other end, we have more people becoming pensioners, and those pensioners living longer, and they are drawing more and more money from the pension system. So the pressure for spending is immense, but the money to actually meet all that expenditure really isn't there. Plus, we have this massive debt to service. So something's got to give somewhere, and a giveaway budget, isn't it?
Exactly. Now, so with all the signals coming from government, what's your read of them? Because on the one hand, you hear, just to take Michael Noonan alone, saying as he did, we can do all of this last week, saying we can do what's necessary, achieve our targets, bring the deficit down to below 3% of GDP just by buoyancy. But said, I think it was a week earlier at the Fine Gael Think, and saying we're not going back to boom and bust, we're going to be sensible, we're not going to do anything to endanger the recovery, and so on and so on. So what's your read of what's behind all the rhetoric? Because the rhetoric seems to be pointing in different directions, even from the same individual.
Yeah, and what you had in between those two statements was that set of growth numbers last week, which has rearranged everybody's mathematics, including some of the figures from the Fiscal Council here, which haven't been updated to take account of those extraordinary growth figures from last week.
7%. Unbelievable.
That was the annualised figure. For this year, it's probably going to come in for calendar 2014, somewhere around 5% is what most private sector economists are guessing. Still a huge growth level compared to what we've been used to, and the highest in the European Union. So pretty extraordinary bounce back. But does that mean it's time to fire the starting gun on another boom and another spending round? No, because, I mean, these are very, very recent turn in the economy.
And even though that's what every single Fine Gael backbencher, for example, that we pointed a microphone at the Fine Gael Think and said, time to give some money back.
Yeah, and that's understandable because there have been 8 consolidation budgets. It really has been a long, hard slog to try and get the state finances back into shape and deal with the banking crisis and deal with a very big recession at the same time. It has been immensely difficult for politicians and for everybody in this country. And so there's a very understandable urge to try and ease back at the earliest possible moment. And also you get the politicians using that phrase, we're not just running an economy, we're running a society here. And societies are collections of voters, aren't they? So there's pressures coming on them from all sides, and they will want to try and give back what they can, where they can. And they know they're quite constrained in what they can do, but they will try and do something. Remember, in each of the budgets of this government, there has been tax cuts. You haven't noticed them probably, unless you're in the restaurant industry or construction industry, but there have been tax cuts all along, and their tax cutting strategy has always been aimed at trying to stimulate employment growth, because that is the key to having growth in the wider economy and correcting the public finances faster. So they'll probably will carry on with doing that sort of tax relief, but whether it's going to be any kind of a general massive tax cut, that's harder to conjecture, other than the fact that there is an election coming up and they would like to try and do something for a lot of people that will get a lot of attention.
Sean Whelan, thank you very much. And we'll be talking to Professor John McHale of the Fiscal Advisory Council about that advice after 8 o'clock.
35,000 new houses need to be built in Dublin over the next 4 years, but more planning permission is needed to build them. So say auctioneers in a study of the capital's housing needs. House prices have risen by over 10% in Dublin over the last year alone. Simon Stokes is chair of the Residential Agency Group of the Society of Chartered Surveyors Ireland. He's here with us now. Simon, thank you for coming in.
Good morning.
Tell us more about what you found in the study.
We've looked at housing supply and housing requirements from 2014 to 2018 in the Dublin area. Starting off, I suppose, the basic thing you need to build houses is land. And we've identified that there's approximately 2,200 hectares of residential zone land in the four local authorities. And that comprises about 2.4% of the land area. And that gives a potential for approximately 100,000 housing units, which in turn gives potential to house approximately 270,000 people. We've looked at the housing requirements over the next 4 years, and there's a minimum of 35,000, but planning permission exists for only 26,000. And within that 26,000 existing planning permissions, there may be a higher ratio of apartments to houses. And the other issue that's going to arise when people try to build these is that many of those permissions are older permissions which are not compliant with new building regulations. So although there's existing permission for 26,000 units, many of those units may not be suitable or may not be built.
And many of the planning permissions exist in parts of the city where there isn't a big demand.
Absolutely. It was always thus, I suppose, the highest demand is where there is least supply. Nonetheless, although the Dublin City Council area shows the largest shortfall, it's reasonable to assume that people who want to live in the Dublin City Council area will, by virtue of necessity, live in the outer local authority areas where there is potential to supply housing.
Okay, so you've looked at what here? The amount of land that's zoned for building houses but where houses haven't been built or where planning or have planning permission to build. On what basis do you know that there is a need for houses in those areas?
We engaged Future Analytics Consulting and they have looked at population trends. They did an urban area study on housing requirement, population growth, and using those figures, we worked out how many houses, or at least they worked out for us, how many houses would be required. It's interesting today in the Financial Times, there's reference made to Ireland's housing market and how there's a ghost estates in one part of the country and a housing shortage in Dublin.
Yes.
But we would argue that to have any hope of attracting further foreign direct investment, Dublin needs to have reasonably priced housing available. Most of the foreign direct investment into Ireland appears to want to come to or near Dublin, and it's essential that we have enough housing for their workers so that we can be competitive on cost
yes.
and quality of life.
But your study, and I've looked through it as much as I possibly can, but I don't see you quantifying what the demand for housing is.
Well, we have. We've quantified that there's a minimum requirement of 35,000 houses required within the four local authority areas in the next 4 years.
On what, on what basis?
On population growth projections, CSO figures that future.
This study has a look of building houses to be sold rather than a need for houses to be built to be lived in. Is that fair?
Well, no. I'm not aware of any houses being sold at the moment for any other purpose than living in. And house prices.
No, but the parts where planning permission are, the parts where you're looking for extra planning permission are in parts where there isn't a big demand for houses to be lived in at the moment.
I'm not sure I'd agree with that. We see fairly strong demand right across the four local authorities in Dublin. The existing housing stock that's available for moving into either to rent or to buy is being mopped up very quickly by the market. House price increases and rental increases show that demand exists and that there is insufficient supply at the moment right across the Dublin area.
Is planning permission the only barrier?
No, the main barrier actually to building houses at the moment is finance. We gave government a pre-budget submission of 10 points which would help increase supply in the short term. Some of the ones that we brought in were, or suggested that should be brought in, were reducing windfall tax from 80 to 33% on development land, revolving infrastructure funds. This is very important because although we've identified 2,200 hectares of residential zoned land, the vast majority of that may be inadequately serviced. So although the land is technically available, in practical terms, it's not shovel-ready and not suitable for development.
Simon Stokes, thank you for coming into that. Simon Stokes, Chair of the Residential Agency Group with the Society of Chartered Surveyors Ireland.
Party conference season begins in Britain. There are signs of disagreement about what further powers will be further devolved to Scotland and how and when. On the line from London, the political editor of the Financial Times, George Parker. Good morning and thanks for taking the call. Could you just remind us before we get into this, George, what potential powers were outlined, extra powers for the Scottish Parliament, were outlined in this cross-party vow or pledge that was given to the Scots before they voted?
Well, you're right. This vow was made on the front page of the Daily Record, Scotland's biggest-selling newspaper, by the three main party leaders at Westminster. And they promised that they would devolve to Holyrood, the Scottish Parliament, new powers over tax and welfare, and those are the two main areas. No specifics, that's the important thing to bear in mind, because the three parties at Westminster haven't agreed exactly which powers should be passed on to Holyrood, but those are essentially the main ones, including the power to vary income tax. And in some cases, for example, the Conservatives are saying that Holyrood should have complete control over income tax and income tax rates.
Now, there are several layers to the complications that are beginning to appear. The first, I suppose, the most direct of direct concern to Mr. Cameron is the problem in his own party. What's the problem?
Yeah, well, this is a Conservative and Unionist party committed to the union with Scotland, and there's a huge strand of thought in the Conservative Party that, you know, that this is leading down the path of the breakup of the United Kingdom. If you start giving the Scots power over, for example, income tax, then that's really pushing the country a further step along the road, possibly to independence at some future date. So they're very concerned about that, and has to be borne in mind also the Conservative Party only has one Westminster MP elected by Scottish voters, and it's predominantly an English party, so they're very nervous about that.
Is the bottom line that the linkage which Mr. Cameron envisaged immediately after the referendum between more powers for Scotland and more powers for everyone else, and particularly the English, that's kind of beginning to look a bit flaky?
Well, it's certainly looking very difficult to deliver, because what David Cameron said, as he said on the doorstep of No. 10 Downing Street the morning of that vote in Scotland, was we're going to pass these powers on to Scotland, but by the way, we're going to resolve this English question, the question of why English MPs shouldn't be allowed to have votes on their own laws when Scottish MPs can currently vote on those laws, even though they don't apply in Scotland. So it's the 100-year-old West Lothian question. It's the question which politicians and constitutional experts have been grappling with for 100 years or so, and David Cameron wants to try to resolve this in the next few months. One of the reasons he wants to do that, by the way, is that UKIP, despite its name of the UK party, is actually also predominantly an English party, and is also saying, hang on a sec, we're giving these new powers to Scotland, what about the English? So David Cameron's trying to head off that particular danger as well.
Yeah, Nigel Farage, I see, asking the Scottish MPs to pledge not to vote on yeah, English questions, which is a fairly smart move, whatever you might think of the rights and wrongs of it. Now, what about Labour, who are they're starting their annual conference? Are they nervous? Are they going to be the target of an attack, or could they be offsided by where this is happening, or is it an advantage for a potential opportunity for them?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that David Cameron looked the one who was awkward. He looked like he'd sort of given away too much to the Scots, and had the Tory party on his back. Now Labour have got a problem, of course, which is that if David Cameron and indeed Nigel Farage and UKIP start making a big issue about the fact that the English are badly treated in this new constitutional settlement, then Ed Miliband has a problem, because if you weaken the right of Scottish MPs at Westminster to vote at Westminster, that's a massive problem for Labour. Labour have 40 MPs elected by Scottish voters, out of a total of about 250 at the moment. So there's a real danger that if Ed Miliband were to become Prime Minister under these plans, he could have a majority in Great Britain, but not a majority of English MPs. So there could be huge areas of legislation he wants to pass, for example, school reform in England, or health reform in England, or even changing the income tax in England, which he wouldn't be able to get through the Westminster Parliament, because half his Scottish, or his entire Scottish block of MPs wouldn't be allowed to vote. So that's a big problem for Labour.
Well, the pre-referendum pledge was certainly not specific, as you said, so it's certainly getting complicated now. But George Parker of the Financial Times in London, thank you very much.
You live, you pay tax, you die, and Kerry win all Ireland's life certainties. And this morning, sports news for it, Lud.
It's Gavin, good morning. A night of celebration for Kerry GA fans. They did the double yesterday, winning the All-Ireland titles in senior and minor. In the senior final, goals from Paul Ganey and Kieran Donaghy saw them beat Donegal by 2-9 to 12 points to claim a 37th title and a first since 2009. line defender Paul Murphy was named as a man of the match. Probably not a final that will live long in most people's memory. They secured the first minor title in 20 years earlier in the day with a 17-10 win also against Donegal. Manager Jack O'Connor has now led his county to All-Ireland titles at minor, under 21 and senior levels. Well, after the senior game, Robbie Irwin spoke to an emotional Kieran Donaghy.
It was a tough year for me. I didn't think I'd get back here. But you know, I just persevered. I stuck with it. My missus kept me going. She kept making juices every morning, kept telling me to stay with it. I'd make it back. And huge credit has to go to her. Keep my spirits up when things were very hard. But it's just a massive win for Kerry and the minors. To see the minors win as well is excellent.
And what a day for yourself. I mean, to put in a performance like that on the biggest day, the biggest stage of the year, given the year that you had.
Yeah, I know. Look, it was... Oh man, I'm still overwhelmed, I'll be honest about it. But I'm blessed and privileged that I'm a part of the Kerry thing. You know, there's 37 All-Irelands now. We're gonna have more. And I'm just a part of the line. I'm minding this number 14. Some other fella could have it next year. I'm going to be up there in the terraces for the next 30 years looking down at other guys wearing it. And I'm just blessed and privileged that I got the chance.
This is an amazingly emotional Kieran Donaghy.
It is. I'm an emotional guy. I wear my hat on my sleeve. I don't lie about it. I take things bad when they're going bad. But I take the good things when they come. And look, as I said, I'm just looking to be a part of this team. I'm only an old codger hanging around. The young fellas really drove it home for us today.
It's Kieran Donaghy, the moment captured perfectly there shortly after the final whistle. And an incredible journey for the team as well, given that when the league was on, there was talk of a crisis in Kerry football.
And his introduction towards the end of the first of the draw, or the first of the semi-finals, it really turned the championship for Kerry, it seemed.
It certainly did, yeah. And he admitted himself that he didn't think he'd get back there. But there has to be a loser as well. And Donegal manager Jim McGuinness gave a frank assessment of his team's performance yesterday.
It's a big occasion, there's no doubt about that, and there's a weight of expectation maybe that you could win the All-Ireland, your favourites to win it. I don't know if that's a factor or not. Regardless, we still didn't perform, and it's one of very few times where we haven't, to be honest with you. It's disappointing that it's in the final, but we have to live with it now. You know, you get 70 minutes to play the All-Ireland final and there's no point talking about it afterwards. Our time was to play it was at 3:30 the day, and we didn't get to the level required to win the All-Ireland, and we must acknowledge that, and we must wish Kerry well and their victory, and we need to move on. We could have snook a draw, you know, and maybe we could have got a different performance the next day, but over the course of the 70 minutes, in my opinion, we didn't deserve to win the All-Ireland. We have high standards, we work on things, we try to develop the players, we try to develop the game plan on a constant basis, and you know, when it comes to game day, you want to deliver a performance worthy of all that work and everything that was put in. And the difficult part for the management and the players is that we didn't do that today to the level that's required to win an All-Ireland, but it wasn't there the day, and that again, that is the disappointing thing.
That's Jim McGuinness. We'll be hearing live from the Kerry Hotel in an hour's time. In soccer, plenty of excitement in the English Premier League. There was a 1-1 draw between Manchester City and Chelsea. Former Chelsea player Frank Lampard came on as a late substitute and scored the equalising goal for Manchester City, but he didn't celebrate afterwards, and he admitted that it was an unusual afternoon for him.
I just tried to do my normal job, you know, as a professional, and arrived on one and bounced it into the net. So it's strange, yeah. I think the reception I got from the Chelsea fans as I came on, before I scored, to be fair, it was amazing, and they were silent, and then at the end they were amazing again. I spent 13 amazing years with them, so I can't speak highly enough from that. And at the same time, City, I mean, come here and, as I say, you do your job, and special and weird day for me.
Manchester United were 2-0 up and 3-1 up, but they ended up losing 5-3 to Leicester City. West Brom won 1-0 at Tottenham for their first league win of the season, while Crystal Palace, also without a league win, came from behind to beat Everton 3-2 at Goodison Park. Chelsea remained top with 13 points from their 5 matches, followed by Southampton and Aston Villa on 10 points. In the SSE Airtricity League Premier Division, Cork City beat Limerick 1-0 at Thomond Park. Rob Lee Han with the goal. The win cuts Dundalk's lead at the top of the table to 3 points, and Celtic drew 1-1 1-all at home to Motherwell in the Scottish Premiership. Shane Lowry finished in a tie for second place at the Wales Open Golf in Celtic Manor. He shot a final round of 70 to end on 13 under par alongside England's Tommy Fleetwood, and they were one shot behind the winner Dutchman Joost Luiten. Another Offaly man, jockey Pat Smullen, reached 100 winners in a season for the first time as Broach ended denied British raider Regardez in the feature Group 3 filly stakes at Goran Park. She was returned the 11-8 favourite. Ireland's under 21 eventing team won the team gold medal at the European Championships in Portugal. The team of Elizabeth Hayden, Josh Pym, Jodie O'Keefe and Harold McGahey saw off a determined challenge from the German team, with Britain in third. Elizabeth Hayden also won the individual bronze medal with her Irish bred horse Miracle. Lewis Hamilton was first home in the Singapore Formula 1 Grand Prix, with Sebastian Vettel and Daniele Ricciardo following. Donegal's Declan Boyne, meanwhile in a Subaru, won the Clare Rally, the penultimate round of the Dunlop National Rally Championship. He finished a minute and 14.4 seconds ahead of Welsh driver Hugh Hunter.
Pádraig, thank you. 7.42, plenty more on Kerry's All-Ireland win later in the programme. Would it cost to give breakfast to a child at school? 70 cent a day, according to Healthy Food for All, who say that €1.8 million would cover breakfast at school for all children in 800 schools in disadvantaged areas. Sinead Keenan is project coordinator. She's with us now. Sinead, thank you very much for coming in to us. There are schools already running breakfast clubs. Can you just tell us how they work at the moment?
There's a difference in the type of breakfast club that are provided at the moment. Some are simply, slice of toast or a cereal just as you're going into school. What we're trying to establish is a good standard, a quality standard of breakfast clubs. So it's a club, a social club for children to come to school early. In the four schools that our pilot program has set up breakfast clubs, we have children coming to school an hour earlier. They're learning about new foods. They're trying out a variety of new foods, whether that's fruit, toast, cereal. In one school, we have soft boiled egg and beans on toast as well.
Now, there is a programme in schools, particularly in DESH schools, and it's available in lots of other schools as well, where they will get school lunches provided for free every day.
Yeah.
So the programme for breakfast is simply extending that scheme, is it?
It is. We're asking An Tán Éisteacht to provide an additional €1.8 million to the school meals programme in next month's budget to provide a national breakfast club programme. We see that there's additional benefits to providing breakfast to children. It gets them into class on time. It gets them well fed, ready to learn. So we're starting all children off on an equal footing, regardless of their background. They're having something to eat and they're ready to hit. The teachers are telling us that they're happier coming into the classroom and they're ready to eat.
Okay, €1.8 million, which on top of, I think it's 30 or 40 odd is already spent on school meals programmes,
yeah.
So it seems fairly small. But where does that money go? Is that on food or is that on infrastructure?
That's on the food item. We're also looking for Department of Education to provide a small grant scheme of €500,000 to ensure that all schools can make any small renovations they need in order to provide food on schools and meet environmental health standards.
When you think of the costs involved in providing a breakfast for a child, whether it be at home or at school, it may seem astonishing to many listening this morning and many children who are eating their breakfast that there are plenty of children who don't get to eat breakfast before going to school.
We know that there's 1 in 5 children in Ireland are going to school or to bed hungry because there's not enough food in the home. And we see that breakfast clubs are a real opportunity to address this this issue.
Would the money not, for example, be better spent by giving it back to, say, an increase in child benefits so that those breakfasts could be provided at home?
We would see that by having an opportunity to come into breakfast clubs, children are experiencing food in a healthy, positive environment. They have an opportunity to socialise positively around food and have a positive experience, and we feel that those messages then come back into the home later in the day.
Are you getting any inkling as to whether this is likely to happen?
An Tán Éisteacht has indicated that she's supportive of the school meals programme in the pre-budget form, so we're hoping that she will put be able to allocate additional funds to the school meals programme in next month's budget.
Sinead, thank you very much for coming. This is Sinead Keenan, Project Coordinator of Healthy Food for All.
Turkey has begun to close some of its border crossings with Syria. This is after it's reckoned that in the last 4 or 5 days, about 100,000 Kurdish refugees crossed over into Turkey from Syria, fleeing from Islamic State militants. We'll be coming to that news directly after 8 o'clock. But first, a group of people who are following that news very closely indeed. Many of the approximately 2,000 Kurds settled in Ireland have family members back in northern Iraq, some of them Peshmerga fighters, defending their homeland against the militants. Carol Coleman spoke to a group of Iraqi Kurds now settled in Carrick and Shannon.
Sit down, Jabbar, please.
It's dinner time, and Fozia Amiri, who came to Ireland 9 years ago as part of a UN refugee resettlement programme, is serving rice and soup. Most here spent years in refugee camps, having fled Saddam Hussein's regime. Now, with extremists threatening Kurdish northern Iraq, they're seeing it all happening again.
Of course I'm worried, because sometimes when I look at the Yazidis, what happening to them, I remember myself what was happening to us, especially when we moved down to Jordan. And of course I can't tolerate, and the tears come down into my eyes.
That's Lola Alakarami. Extremist brutality also worries Nazamin Azizi, because like most here, she maintains close ties to northern Iraq.
My brother and my boyfriend is Peshmerga too.
So what did they tell you?
They told me, like, the people that died there, other, like, children, women, and old men, how bad they died, you know. And they're taken some place off Kurdistan, but now Peshmerga got it back, so we're happy now.
Do you think they'll be able to hold it, to keep it?
Yeah, I think. Because I know they're the best army, so they could do their best, you know.
Will they be able to destroy ISIS?
I think they do. Yeah, they will.
Another woman has four brother-in-laws in the Peshmerga. These days, they're away from home fighting. The snippets of news that reach the small Carrick Kurdish community through Skype and Facebook are causing sleepless nights for everyone here.
Yesterday, two Peshmerga beside my brother's house is die. It's not easy. It's very hard for people. All my country is scared.
And have your families actually seen the ISIS? Like, have they seen them in their towns?
No, but it's not much far away from them, like 200 kilometers like that, yeah.
Though the international coalition is not providing boots on the ground, those gathered here are grateful for any support for the fight against the so-called Islamic State militants. As the evening goes on, the talk turns to what the Islamic State is all about. Serbast Omar Mohammed Amin is in no doubt that they are not Muslim.
They are showing them. They are showing themselves. They are showing that they are not Muslim. They are really wrong understanding about the Muslim. They are politic group. And I don't know who is behind them. Maybe there's a big country behind them, what they are doing, they're supporting them.
Nouri Azizi agrees.
They are just normal terrorists. Now everyone can listen about that, they call Allahu Akbar. But everyone can say Allahu Akbar. It's not like that I say Allahu Akbar and I kill people.
In Carrick and Shannon, Kurdish news is watched on satellite channels. The television is now switched off because, as Joanna Ahmadi says, the news from home is sometimes just too difficult to watch.
When I hear my parents are talking about and I can't stop crying, so I say, stop, don't talk about it. And I'm not going to watch TV and news anymore. So
you tend to follow it less than you?
Yeah, I was following, you know, all the time. But when I saw all the situation, when I remember myself, so I said, no, I'm not going to watch it anymore.
And that's Carol Coleman reporting on the Kurds of Carrick and Shannon. As I say, we'll be coming to that situation, increasingly serious situation, on the Turkish-Syrian border after 8. Time for the business again from Emma.
Thanks, Cathal. The tough choices on the Irish economy have already been made, it says, but an editorial in today's Financial Times says early glimmers of optimism should not be mistaken for a return to the carefree days of easy growth. And this comes as the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council warns that fiscal discipline needs to be sustained to reduce the national debt and that the government needs to keep a prudent fiscal stance in the budget next month. We're joined now by Justin Urquhart-Stewart of Seven Investment Management. Justin, a congratulatory warning maybe this morning from the Financial Times, but that's just one view from outside of the Irish economy. How do you read it?
A significant change indeed. You've got to be careful to make sure you don't overdo it, but you can see a rising level of confidence, and I've seen that directly throughout certain parts of the country. But also we've got the current account surplus, we've got inward investment rising, and we've even seen, dare I say, some of the property market in Dublin starting to rise as well. These are positive signs. There are still going to be those horrific totems of the disasters of the empty ghost estates which will be there, which reflect what happened in the past. But nonetheless, we've seen some improvements. Don't get too carried away, though. Remember that 120% of the value of the economy is in national debt at the moment. But what you've had is a benefit of a rising US economy, a rising UK economy, but the Eurozone is still in a depressed state. But overall, I would say the glass is certainly more than half full at the moment.
How would you say being carried away would manifest itself? What would the worst things to do be?
The worst thing to do would be actually now to start actually encouraging everybody to start going out and borrowing again. That's going to be quite difficult to do because the banks aren't in a fit state to be able to do so. But to be able to make sure that actually we have reasonable recovery. At the moment, the figures are looking quite strong. What you don't want is to have the economy overheating again. Otherwise, we will go back to another boom and bust. It's slow and steady. It may sound dull, but when it comes to running an economy, dull's actually quite good.
Well, that is a sentiment that's echoed by the Fiscal Council this morning. It's warning this morning that policy here has tended to contribute to boom-bust cycles and that we have to break that pattern. How can we do that now in the situation that we're currently in?
What you've got to be able to do is make sure that investment is carried out on a measured basis. And that may be frustrating for some, who people see there's the opportunity for buying assets which are now cheap and they can actually develop money, develop them quickly and make a quick return. No, what you want to be able to do is to make sure that you have long-term investments coming in, which we're beginning to see more of in terms of inward investment. Ireland's in a much better position than, say, the United Kingdom, which has had a question on it with regard to the Scottish referendum and, of course, even the EU referendum. So it is still attracting more money coming in, and that's what external investors need to be seeing. But domestically, what you want to be able to see is not a growth-positive economy, but not one which is going to encourage outwardly high levels of investment for people taking too much risk. Calm it down, slow and steady.
You mentioned external investors. What about the health of our overseas trading partners, specifically the UK and the US?
UK and US are actually looking in not bad shape at all. The UK is actually looking quite good. I have to say the recovery is good, but it's have to question how sustainable it's going to be at the moment, but it's okay. The US, they will keep everything necessary going because they will both keep low interest rates. The real concern at the moment is the depressive state of the Eurozone. And I don't mean the periphery states so much as the core. France is in a very flat position indeed and not looking good and politically not looking strong. And even Germany at the moment, Mrs. Merkel will do what is necessary to get things moved. But what you've had is the ECB now cutting rates to the extent that bank deposits within the central bank are now negative. Banks have to pay interest to put money there. But I'm afraid the ECB is a bit like standing there with a damp box of matches and a wet firework. It's not going off. What you need to do is encourage growth in the core, and that's more difficult. Otherwise, we're heading for more disinflation, which could lead to deflation, which could mean the core of the Eurozone could start looking like Japan unless action is taken.
And if we in Ireland are going to have to rely on our exports and attracting overseas investments, do you think we'll make it through?
I think you will, because you're an open economy, which has shown its flexibility. It's been very painful, as you've seen with changes to the population, but actually come through the other side. Those economies which aren't as flexible will see more pain. I underline France. And so, therefore, it's going to be more difficult for them. You have the ability to actually not be so dependent necessarily on the Eurozone, although it's much better if it was doing better, but your other two main trading partners are still positive. So that's an encouraging sign. But nonetheless, everybody should be doing everything necessary to get the Eurozone authorities, and particularly the ECB, to get the inflation pressures going again and get some more growth back into the core.
Justin Urquhart, Steward of Seven Investment Management, thanks very much for joining us this morning. In other business news, a statement from retailer Tesco this morning says it's overstated its expected first half profit by an estimated $250 million and has launched a review to find out why. The firm said it discovered the overstatement made as part of an August 29th profit warning during its final preparations for its forthcoming interim results, which will now be announced on October 23rd rather than October 1st. And the trading statement is Tesco's third profits warning in a matter of weeks. Tesco, it said, identified an overstatement in its expected profit for the half year, principally due to the accelerated recognition of commercial income and a delayed accrual of costs. On the currency markets this morning, the euro is trading at $1.286 and at 78.6 pence sterling.
Emma, thank you. Let's get a weather forecast now from Vincent O'Shea at Met Air. Good morning, Vincent.
Thank you, Gavin. Good morning from Met Éireann. Any inland fog will clear quickly, and apart from a little drizzle and light rain near northwest coast during the afternoon, today will be dry with variable cloud and pleasant sunny spells. Winds, mainly from the southwest, will be light, highest temperature 16 to 18 degrees. Most areas will be dry tonight. Some mist will develop inland once again. Southwest winds will be very light, but however, a little drizzle or light rain will occur in places, mainly across the north and west. It'll be a very mild night, lowest temperatures of 7 to 10 degrees. It'll be a cloudy start tomorrow with some patchy drizzle and light rain during the morning, but it will brighten up for the afternoon everywhere with some sunny breaks. However, more persistent rain will affect the far northwest during the evening. Southwest winds will be very light again tomorrow, highest temperatures 15 to 17 degrees. And the outlook is for the rest of the week to be very mild and mostly dry. In detail, apart from a little drizzle in the north and west of the country, Tuesday night will be dry and mild. Wednesday will be mostly cloudy but a dry day, apart from the odd isolated shower near northwest coasts. Any sunny breaks though will be short and limited to the Midlands, the south and east. And little changes expected for Thursday. It's going to stay mostly dry but cloudy. It'll be very mild again with temperatures in the mid to high teens and light southwest winds. Then, while a little light rain is possible in the north and west during Friday, the weather will remain mostly dry and settled going into next weekend with light winds and well above normal temperatures. Finally, I'll leave you with a recap on today. It'll be mostly dry with pleasant sunny spells, though a little rain will affect the northwest later. That's the forecast. Good morning.